watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The program this week presents material that is both dire and urgent. Both our speakers believed in an American ideal. Both went into the military to defend what they believed in, and both found they had been dangerously mistaken. They are bringing us warnings and calling us to action to avert a totalitarian nightmare, and time is of the essence. Our first speaker will be Daniel Ellsberg, a former defense analyst who became famous, or some would say infamous, during the Vietnam War after he leaked a secret Pentagon study he helped write that revealed the real history and purposes of the U.S. government in Vietnam. These came to be known as the Pentagon Papers. Ellsberg served during the 1950s as an officer in the U.S. Marine Corps, then earned his Ph.D. in economics from Harvard after leaving the Marines. During the 1960s, he worked for the Rand Corporation, the Defense Department, and spent 2 years at the U.S. Embassy in Saigon evaluating pacification on the front lines for the State Department. Returning to the Rand Corporation in 1967, he was one of the writers of a top-secret McNamara study of U.S. decision-making in Vietnam 1945 to 1968, which later became known as the Pentagon Papers. In 1969, he photocopied the 7,000-page study and gave it to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. After they took no action, 2 years later, he gave the material to the New York Times, the Washington Post, and 17 other newspapers. He was then charged with 12 felony counts posing a possible sentence of 115 years, but the charges were later dismissed on the grounds of governmental misconduct against him, which led to the convictions of several White House aides and figured in the impeachment proceedings against President Richard Nixon. He spoke last week in Maplewood, New Jersey. Daniel Ellsberg.
Well, history is repeating itself to a certain extent here. For instance, the news of the day is that the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader have found something to agree on, namely the need for investigation. Now, they're being pressed, of course, to investigate the intelligence that lied us into the war, or the use of intelligence by the President that lied us into the war. They've been resisting that now for a couple of years. Various other investigations that the Democratic minority is pressing them to do. But they are now, have agreed as of today, that we do need an investigation, namely into the disclosure, the leak, of alleged secret U.S. interrogation centers abroad. Condi Rice, of course, in denouncing this leak, will not confirm whether there are such alleged secret, have to be secret, you know, interrogation centers abroad. But definitely agrees that you need to investigate that leak. Now, that's in line, of course, with the president's reaction when someone leaked the name of Valerie Plame, a CIA operative, and thus rolling up her efforts to counter proliferation. Very clear loss to national security, one that I would agree was something, a leak that I would not have made, but the president's attitude at the time was, we're against all leaks. Anybody who leaked this, we will investigate, we'll find out who it was, and I want anyone in my administration who knows anything about the discussion of Valerie Plame's name with reporters to come forward and enlighten us. And three people who weren't listening to that, apparently, were named Cheney, Libby, and Rove, apparently. So there is some ambivalence about leaks. There's good leaks and bad leaks from the point of view of the administration. And that goes back a long way. As was mentioned in the introduction, I leaked 7,000 pages of top-secret material in 1971. And the president's reaction to that at the time... Thank you. We now know what the president's actual reaction to that was. I knew that we got half of the reaction, but it was somewhat misleading. He enjoined the New York Times from putting out any further documents on that. Started coming out on Sunday, June 13th. And on June 14th, Monday the 14th, Times was warned about this. And on Tuesday, they were enjoined from any further, putting out anything further. What had come out so far had been on Lyndon Johnson. So we knew that part of the reaction. But now we have the tapes. I only heard them a couple of years ago for the first time myself, just before my book came out. So they're in the book. And I've listened to these tapes over and over. It's a little hard sometimes to figure out who's saying what. But I have listened a lot, so I know them almost by heart here. On Monday, the day that the injunction went out, we now know the president's reaction was, stuff on Kennedy, I'm going to leak. We'll just leak it out. Now that it's being leaked, we'll leak out the parts we want. And that ran into the problem that, of course, he just issued an injunction to the New York Times saying that any further disclosure of any of this information, which might undermine the prestige of the presidency, of which he was the latest representative, would harm national security to such a point that it would be virtually treasonous to publish another line of this stuff. Well, so how is he going to get out this stuff on Kennedy? We're going to leak it out. So he calls in Haldeman on the tape. You can hear this. The injunction was only to the Times, right? And Haldeman reassures him. So they enjoined the Post after I'd given it to the Post a couple of days later. And then the Boston Globe came out with a big picture of John F. Kennedy. President says, did they get him? What he was very interested in was assuring that President Kennedy was tarred with the assassination of Ziem, Catholic head of state, co-religionist, partner of ours, because in 71 he still feared that Ted Kennedy was his most serious rival for the presidency, even after Chappaquiddick. And so he wanted to tar Ted Kennedy with the fact that his brother had killed a Catholic head of state, and this would hurt Ted with the Catholic vote here. So they said, did they get Ziem? Great, we've got to do this. What they found in the Pentagon Papers when the stuff did come out on Ziem, which was some days later when papers resumed publishing, that they didn't have proof that Kennedy was actually had given the order for the assassination of Ziem. So he had Howard Hunt, I'll get that to a moment, who he'd hired shortly before that, for several purposes, which I'll explain. Colson, the new prison chaplain, essentially the head of the Christian movement in the prisons, having spent some time there himself, he called Colson in. By the way, he gave Colson the job of leaking out the stuff on Ziem. Kennedy was a little hesitant, and Colson, who had just said any leak is absolutely intolerable, he had assured the president the day before, and the day later, the president is saying. To Colson, oh yes, he had just said, Colson had just said, you simply cannot allow a newspaper to publish classified documents. So 2 days later, President calls him in and gives him the order to leak out the Ziem documents. Now, the Ziem documents in the papers did not sufficiently incriminate his predecessor, Kennedy. So Colson asked Hunt to improve on that, namely to forge it. And Hunt did that. He then forged documents that indicated that the president had directly ordered the assassination of Ziem. And he tried to pass that to Life magazine. Life wanted the originals of the cables that supposedly did this, and since Hunt had put this together with scissors and tape and Xerox and whatnot, felt that the originals wouldn't withstand an expert scrutiny and wouldn't give him them. So Life didn't come out with that. That is of interest this week, as a matter of fact, for two reasons. 40 years later, after the events, we now have information that the cables which supposedly incriminated or inculpated the North Vietnamese in an attack on our destroyers on August 4th, 1964, the second Tonkin Gulf raid, an attack which did not take place. And what convinced the president supposedly that it had taken place were cables, which it has now been revealed by a National Security Agency in-house study, which has been described in the papers now recently. Those cables were forged, were tampered with. There were original cables, but they'd fooled around with the dates and the contents of the cables in such a way as to make it look as if the attack, cables relating to an attack that did occur in daylight on August 2nd, 1964, to which we did not respond, had actually referred to August 4th, the ones to which we did, quote, respond, the attack that did not occur, if you're following that. So we have a forgery now coming out after 40 years. If you want to know what the big secret that they've been holding on to in the White House, that they're very concerned, why they were so concerned with Joe Wilson, there's increasing indications, again, in the last 2 weeks, in the last days, that the core secret they were holding on to was that the cables supposedly indicating that Saddam was seeking uranium from Niger were forged. And the fact that they've been forged, that they were forged, has been known for some time. What has been, well, after the war started, what has been coming out more and more recently was the degree of involvement of Americans in that path of forgery. And apparently Cheney was concerned from the very first about Joe Wilson that he might know about that forgery. For one thing, because his wife was in the counterproliferation section of the clandestine service in CIA, and if anybody knew about it, she and her colleagues were likely to know about it and could tell Joe Wilson. For exactly similar reasons, the president was concerned about what I was putting out. What I'm saying, telling you now, is that there is an almost identical replay of history in this situation. At that time, too, there was a former official, me, who had put out information showing that various White Houses, White House administrations, had lied us into a war to the same degree we were lied in to this war. I'm saying, I go back, the White House, the Senate resolution delegating to the president an open-ended commitment to go to war, an undated declaration of war, an unconstitutional act by the Senate, in which all but 23 Democrats signed in the Senate, had been misled on that issue by, among other things, intelligence estimates and statements by the president based on this forgery, just as almost 40 years earlier, the Senate, also then a Democratic Senate, had been lied into the war in part by forged cables over the Tonkin Gulf, White House deceptions and other deceptions. So here was somebody now, going back in my case, who had put out information on various presidents showing that they had lied. I was claiming that the president, the new president, was lying to the same degree as his predecessors. I didn't actually have documents to prove that. I had some documents on Nixon, which they came to realize. I didn't have what they feared. And however, when they realized that I did have some documents on them, that's what got them very excited about having to do something about me. I'm going to quote some stuff from the tapes, but first let me just show you the parallel that's going on. That set in motion a White House operation, not just to discredit me, but to keep me from putting out further secrets, to intimidate me, to intimidate other people who might leak further, but specifically to get me from putting out further secrets. And in the course of that, the White House committed crimes. Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy were in a group known that called themselves the White House Plumbers on the grounds that they were stopping leaks, committed crimes in order to get information to stop me from further whistleblowing. Specifically, they sent people, former CIA Bay of Pigs veterans, assets, into my former psychoanalyst's office, Dr. Fielding's office in Los Angeles, to get information to threaten that they would put out, threaten me privately with blackmail if I should continue to put out stuff on Nixon. That was the reason they went in there. Most of you probably have never even heard that, even if you remember the incident. Then later, when they didn't find out what they wanted, they brought, again, the same people from CIA Bay of Pigs operations up to incapacitate Ellsberg totally on the steps of the Capitol while I was giving a speech on May 3rd, 1972. When they were found, later in the Watergate, they had some earlier crimes to tell, which put the White House in the kind of trouble that the White House is facing right now. You'll recognize a very similar situation. In this case, they haven't called themselves openly the Plumbers, but it is another Plumbers operation. The White House Iraq group, which had formed in order to sell the war back in 2002, clearly went into action as soon as they feared that Joe Wilson had new information in order to stop Joe Wilson. And as I say, it's increasingly clear to me, I wouldn't say it's proven yet, but increasingly clear that they were not just trying to make him look bad, but trying to warn him off telling what Valerie Plame may have told him, and actually to separate Valerie Plame from her CIA operations. It's a kind of vague statement, but I think there is something there connected with the Niger forgery, the cables. And if you look up, say, on Google about Niger forgery, you'll find plenty of information that's been coming out very recently. Well, just to put this, go back to the, give you a sense of how this fits into history. So I was saying the president had initially very ambivalent Nixon attitudes toward me. He didn't like the idea that someone would take it on themselves to put out classified information. As on the second day, Monday the 14th, after the stuff started coming out, he's told by Ehrlichman that there's an interest in prosecuting the Times. And the president says, hell, I wouldn't prosecute the Times. My view is to prosecute the goddamn pricks that gave it to him. So, yeah, and then when he realizes, however, that what's coming out is actually on the Democrats, on Johnson, he says, wait a minute. They, on the other hand, they're going to run another story tomorrow. Right. Why not just wait till after that one? The next subject. Well, they feel we have to put the Times on notice that there might be violating the law here. And he says, well, could Mitchell wait one more day? They have one more day after that. I don't know. Then he goes into all the leaking stuff that he's going to have. As Kissinger shortly... they go into the injunctions, a fatal move at that point, but they haven't made that mistake again. And with the Supreme Court lifting the injunctions on June 22nd, he says, okay, next step is to the criminal prosecution of Ellsberg. Don't you agree we have to pursue the Ellsberg case now? Mitchell, President, let's get the son of a bitch into jail. We've got to get him. That was... On the tape, you can tell that's not Mitchell. That's we've got to get him. Don't worry about his trial. Just get everything out. Try him in the press. Everything, John Mitchell, that there is on the investigation, that's the grand jury minutes, FBI, get it out. Leak it out. We want to destroy him in the press. Press. Is that clear? Yes. Yavel. And... actually, that was a joke. Kissinger doesn't say yavol. And Mitchell didn't say yavol either, although Liddy, who I've sort of G. Gordon Liddy, always called Mitchell, maybe you don't remember that, Liddy had grown up admiring Hitler. He was known in the White House as, Liddy's a Nazi, but he's our Nazi, as one of them said on the tapes. Hitler was his hero. So Libby tells Liddy, I get this mixed up all the time. G. Gordon Liddy. Liddy always referred to Mitchell as the Attorney General as mein General. Actually makes a point of that with a hard G. So, but Mitchell himself didn't have a German accent. Okay, Kissinger says, yes, if this leads to a situation where all of our enemies in the bureaucracy can leak all of the documents on our administration and force us into defenses, that'll be a real problem. So again, the president goes on how to deal with this. This is the president of the United States now. John Mitchell, the problem is getting the leaks and everything else out, which would indicate these bastards are guilty as hell. I cannot wait for the conviction of Ellsberg and so forth. Mitchell, no, I quite agree. But then he says that Mitchell is too good a lawyer to do this stuff. He worries about the fact that putting out grand jury information is a crime. Fitzgerald, you may have noticed, by the way, is playing this very straight and refusing to put out any information that is not leading to an indictment. But he was afraid that Mitchell might be like that. And so we have to fight this. Meanwhile, he's got two tasks. He wants to put out this stuff on Kennedy and Ziem and go much further than that. He wants to go back to FDR and Yalta and Pearl Harbor. Now, that's very interesting. He says to Haldeman, you know how he knew what was happening, and he did it deliberately. This is interesting. If you listen to the tapes, you hear the President of the United States taking it for granted that FDR had provoked the attack on Pearl Harbor and thus gotten us into the war, for which, by the way, after 50 years, as a good Democrat who grew up revering FDR, there is more indication on that than I was aware at the time. But anyway, the interesting thing is that the Republican president takes that for granted. That's just the way things are done. But the point is to get it out now. And Haldeman points out that, well, the difference is that was all the evidence is circumstance. It's testimony of people. We don't have documents, and this guy Ellsberg has put out documents. So they want to get out all the documents. But that's going to, on Yalta and the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis and all these things, all Democratic things. And he says, let's have a little fun. Takes the eyes off Vietnam. Gets them thinking about the past rather than our present problems. And the second thing was to leak against me, who was on trial at that time. The president, we won the Alger Hiss case in the papers. We did. I had to leak stuff all over the place. It was won in the papers. Some of you are old enough to take an interest in this, especially, right? You don't have to be Abigail's age, even. There was one in the papers. John Mitchell doesn't understand that sort of thing. He's a good lawyer. It's hard for him. Well, what I mean is we have to develop now a program. This is, by the way, this is Joe Wilson. If tapes in the White House now, if we had the tapes, and there may be tapes, actually. You might think, oh, they'd never tape themselves again. But actually, they counted on it not coming out the first time, and they could count on it this time. There may actually be tapes. Certainly, there were people in there. And if they had tape recorders in their pockets, this is what they were hearing. We have to develop now a program for leaking out information. We're destroying these people in the papers. This is a game. It's got to be played in the press. That's why Mitchell can't do that. It isn't possible for him. Haldeman, it's got to be a guy you can really trust because it's got to be run from the White House without being caught. That's the president. So Colson, after all, actually suggests they have to find a guy who will do this. He said, we need a man in the White House who's full-time to do all this stuff. And who can do it? It's got a lot of research here, millions of pages that have to be looked through. So one of my favorite passages, I wanted to put this on the cover of my book, but it didn't fit. While they're looking for me, my wife and I were underground now after the papers, putting out the other copies of the newspapers after the four injunctions, putting them out to 19 newspapers in all. So the FBI was looking all over places they wanted to look, like south of France and Capri, I don't know. There's a lot of junketing going on here. They went to Bermuda. I was in Cambridge, actually, all this time. But while they're looking, they're asking about who can do this massive research task, and the president says, it'll be very good to have somebody who knew the subject. I mean, what you really need is an Ellsberg. An Ellsberg who's on our side. In other words, an intellectual who knows the history of the times, knows what he's looking for. And I must say, when I read that, I thought, Ann Ellsberg, they could have had me. I would have been delighted to do that, even if I was Democrat. I would have come up from underground. I could have done it for myself or whatever. So instead of me, they hired Howard Hunt. Uh-oh, okay, not much left. All right, I'll jump ahead here then. Nixon was facing a Democrat House and Senate. And it wasn't a Democratic House and Senate like the present one or with the present leadership. It was a liberal, the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, as Dean put it, Howard Dean put it. It was a political environment which was very different from Nixon. But more to the point on this point, he faced impeachment from the House, which is very difficult. Well, it's impossible to imagine from a Republican House. And a Democratic Senate seems less out of reach in a way. They can't impeach, but they can investigate and investigate things other than or in addition to the leak of the secret prisons, for example. They can investigate who got us into this war, the forgery, the torture, the prisons themselves, and so forth, the other things that are condemning Iraqis to hell and many Americans to death, many to come, and our country to intense shame. For those of you who are patriots, as I am, and I'm sure this room is filled with them, you know that we have occasion to be ashamed of what is being done in our name, ashamed of the fact that we have a president and I do not believe I would be an iota less ashamed of my president if he were a Democrat in the position of threatening to veto a bill because it banned cruel, unusual, and degrading punishment, or a vice president who was lobbying in that respect. This is a terrible situation and means, by the way, that we have to get a Democratic Senate, and if possible, and I'm just reading now the very first possibility that there could, some pollsters, including Republicans, are imagining a Democratic House in 2006. That will not come easily, obviously. But, you know, months ago, it would have seemed quite incredible. After Katrina, after the failure of the White House plumbers and the demonstration on Katrina, after the increasing evidence of the lies on Iraq and the continuing lies about our victory policy, I think it was yesterday that the president here, let's see here, poster behind the banner behind the president yesterday when he spoke. It was not mission accomplished. That's gone, by the way. It was strategy for victory. Now, did he lay out a strategy for victory? I don't think so. There is no strategy for victory in Vietnam. There was no possibility of a strategy in victory in Vietnam, although many people think there was, that if we bombed enough and so forth, the other side would have quit. I did not believe that. I don't believe that today. We can't prove it. I do not believe that the other side is going to quit their resistance to an American occupation in Iraq ever, and that killing and dying by Americans is going to continue as long as we're there, and I'm afraid that's a long time. It means that getting a Democratic Senate and House is not enough, though it's essential, it's necessary. It's certainly not sufficient for getting us out of Vietnam, out of Iraq, when we have Democratic leaders like Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton who are calling for more troops in Iraq right now. They've got to be gotten off that line. Kerry, I noticed, did get off that line eventually, a little late here, but a couple of weeks ago split from them on the notion that we should reduce there. Changing the composition of Congress is essential to that, and as I say, changing the composition or the stance of our leaders in the Democratic Party is essential. Feingold's position of getting out totally out of Iraq by the end of next year is far better. I would be happy if it were sooner. But let me be frank here. I'm not here just to inspire with illusions here. I think it will be a long time before we get out of Iraq, very long, with Democrats or Republicans. And that Democratic leaders, the Democratic base, the people here would be glad to see us out, as I would, soon, yesterday, tomorrow, very soon. And that would be for the interests of the United States. That does not mean that we're going to get Democratic leaders who are going to give up those bases in Iraq, in the midst of the oil fields there next to Israel. It's going to be a long time, which means a long struggle. We can't give up on that. But there are some things facing us, actually, that are more immediate than the question of whether we get out of Iraq or not in the short run. Here's another piece of information that just came yesterday. A guy named Douglas Thompson, who writes a column called Capital Blue on the Internet, which I follow, says, a confidential memo circulating among senior Republican leaders suggests, back up 1 minute, it's obvious that in the last month we've had more good news about the vulnerability, the expose of the administration than we've had for a very long time, more than we could have expected to get, perhaps, ever. More indications of weakness and the possibility that real work will be repaid this time by changing the gang in Washington. But there is something that can save them from that in a certain way. And here's what the memo circulating among senior Republican leaders suggests: that a new attack by terrorists on U.S. soil could reverse the sagging fortunes of President Bush as well as the GOP and, quote, restore his image as a leader of the American people. It doesn't say he should do it. It says this is, you know, there's reason for hope here, or let's just say there's reason to think that the present low ebb could reverse. And that is, I'm sorry to say, true. That's not just the kind of nonsense that some Republican officials convince themselves of, that we would be greeted with sweets and flowers if we went into Iraq. That was delusional. I wish it could say that thoughts like this are equally delusional. The closely guarded memo lays out a list of scenarios to bring the Republican Party back from the political brink, including a devastating attack by terrorists that could, quote, validate the president's war on terror and allow Bush, quote, to unite the country, end quote, in a time of national shock and sorrow. Now, there are those Republicans, says Thompson, writing this thing. This is on Capitol Blue, November 10th, on the web. There are people who say, well, there are dangers here. Again, let's be clear. Nobody is in the memo or in the Republicans is saying, should we do this, should we not do this? They're saying, what would be the effect if this happened? And there are those who say, well, we have to face the fact, quote, that many Americans no longer trust the president as a longtime GOP strategist. That makes him harder for him to become a rallying point. And other Republicans worry that such a scenario might suggest the president has not done enough to protect the country. Yes, it might go that way. Let me give my own judgment. It's not likely to go that way. I think that in a time of fear and a sense of panic and crisis under these circumstances, the people will do what Americans and everyone else in every other country have always done, and that is to cling to authority, not only the authorities they have, but in particular to favor the ones who look tough and ruthless. A Putin in Russia who is he doing the country any good by his massacres in Chechnya? No, but has it cost him points? Yeah, no. It's been the basis for his popularity there. I believe, and I'm sorry to say this as an American, I believe that one reason that Bush got as close to winning as he did in the last election, close enough to steal the election in Ohio, that the reason that that was enough to push him over, was that many Americans saw him as somebody who could be counted on if Americans died from a terrorist attack to kill some people. Counted on whoever it was. Didn't have to be the people who'd done it, those are impossible to find, as we've discovered, but killed somebody, whether they had anything to do with it or not. That he would not be bound by the Constitution, he would not be bound by laws, he would not be bound by the UN. No one, as he promised us, no one, no French, no people on the Security Council will veto what we're doing. They saw him as an outlaw, out of control person. That's what we need in a time of danger. When I say that about Americans, let me be frank, I'm 74. I no longer see that as just a peculiarly American thing. What I'm saying is I no longer see Americans as all that different from other people in the world, and maybe I'll antagonize some people when I give the following analogy, but I found it very ominous when people responded to the Second Intifada, the use of terrorism by suicide bombers in Israel, where the peace movement and the Yesh Gvul and the Out Now almost collapsed in the face of turning to Ariel Sharon, who by any tactic known to me, and I know a lot of people here may disagree with me in this audience, but I feel made their security worse by his actions in Jenin and elsewhere. And when I saw that happen, I said, that could happen over here. That could happen over here. And that's what did happen over here, I believe, and it could happen again. So let me, and I don't want to end on this note, but I feel to you people who are at the heart of our activist movement here, I want to lay out what I think very quickly is what we're facing. If, for good or bad, as the Republicans would say, if there is another terrorist attack, and obviously I'm putting aside the question of just whether the door might be opened for that, as was opened for the Reichstag fire, if there is another big terrorist attack, I believe that the president, this president, and I pray that it will not be under this president, but that's 3 years to go. He can't be impeached before 2007, and that would take a House, and I hope we get it, a Democratic House. But without that, if there's a terrorist attack, I think the president will get what he wants. And here's what I think he wants. This is my belief. I think he wants a new Patriot Act that has already been drafted, I feel sure, that will make this first Patriot Act look like the Bill of Rights. And the Bill of Rights will be a memory, and I hope it will be a memory, and I think we should start memorizing it right now. Second, military rule in parts of the country for which the president is already pointing to as the solution to the avian flu problem, if we need to quarantine, as the solution to later hurricanes. I think that will, he's preparing the country, I believe, to turn to the military and martial law, basically, in part of the country, if not all of it. Third, this may surprise you, a draft. Everybody knows that a draft is impossible and would be deadly for him this week or next week, despite the fact that all of our Democratic leaders, most of them, are saying we need, not all of them, we're saying we need more troops in Iraq, which we can't have without a draft. We can't keep sending people over for fourth tours, obviously true. To keep our troops there without sending them back again and again, you need a draft. And finally, we have people who are otherwise very good, very progressive, like Rangel, who are saying only a draft is fair. And the problem with that, he uses the word draft. That's unusual. He's for a draft, in part because he thinks that even contemplating the idea will hurt Bush. The problem is that after 9/11, Rangel will get his draft, and he won't like it because it will double the size of the armed forces in Iraq. In fact, triple them. No, if you're going to stay in Iraq, you can't do it with the size we have there now. There's two solutions. Get out or reduce the mission greatly, go back right to the bases right now, lower the casualties. That's not a long-term solution, but they're not about to do that. Or three, get more troops in there, and for that you need a draft. And for a draft, you do need a terrorist incident. But if Osama bin Laden comes through for him again, then he'll get it. Then it'll be men and women. And the problem with Rangel's assessment is, yes, it will be more fair, and it will be a much larger armed force, and it will be engaged in shooting in Iraq and probably in Iran and Syria. Okay, fourth, if not earlier, an attack directly on Iran. which leaks have indicated there is plans already for possibly using nuclear weapons against their WMD underground storage sites and production facilities to demonstrate that we're willing and ready to do that. But even without nuclear weapons, a huge attack which would set the Middle East on fire altogether. Fifth, an Official Secrets Act, which we don't have yet, and in which case you'll see the difference. People will be, Judith Miller will be joined in front of grand juries and in jail by an awful lot of people every week for every leak, and not just for this specialized one. Leaks will become a thing of the past on the whole after some taste of that. There's a couple of other things. What I'm saying is I believe the next terrorist attack, unless we prepare, we in this room, in the ACLU, and other defenders of civil liberties, prepare for it right now, will be the effect the Reichstag fire was in February 27th, 1933, at which point a republic, a democratic republic, the Weimar Republic, changed virtually overnight. The first action taken was actually a decree by Hindenburg, who was still in office, for he died a couple months later. And Hindenburg, the president, put out a decree drafted by Hitler nullifying the segments of the Constitution which guaranteed freedom of the press, freedom of association, privacy of mails, postal service, communication, associations, whatever, essentially their equivalent of the First Amendment, by decree, went the next day. We're facing, I think, that possibility. We have people who are prepared to do that and want to do it. And let me say, when I say this to people, most people of my own persuasion, the reaction I get past is usually, well, that could happen, that's possible. Just for the record, I'm saying, under those circumstances, it is my belief it is not just possible, but highly likely. Unless we're saying right now an attack on Iran is not an acceptable reaction to a 9/11. An Official Secrets Act is not an acceptable answer. One thing I left out. Detentions, first of tens of thousands, next of hundreds of thousands or more of Middle Easterners, Muslims, and others at first, and their, quote, sympathizers. And there might be more than one non-Muslim sympathizer in this room who will be recognized by the president very quickly as a terrorist, as a sympathizer, on the grounds that we oppose the president's policy, like me. And people, I think, will be for the camps in that case. Say that happened overnight. I'm telling you, do you really disagree? I think that would be with the approval of most Americans, or at least half Americans. What would the other half be doing about it? What did they do about the Japanese, 120,000, when I was a kid, who went in, who presented no more of a threat, despite the plausibility, than the bulk of Middle Easterners in this country, the great mass of Middle Easterners? The Supreme Court upheld that at the time. This Supreme Court would uphold this now, without Alito, probably. Okay. What would we do? It is time right now to be saying we need a program for dealing with these measures, which for terrorists, which is a genuine threat, which does not involve destroying our liberties at home and changing our form of government. We need to hear that, and we're not hearing it. It's up to the people here to put that out. If this is going to be, if we are not to be living in a country like Germany after the Reichstag fire, then I think we have to be acting right now. This is a very serious challenge I'm putting here, and it's a very sober stuff. Obviously, to take this seriously, you don't have to agree with me on how likely this is. I think it would be very hard for you, if you think about it, to think that any one of the measures I've talked about is extremely unlikely under those circumstances. And it is interesting to see that the Republicans, according to this confidential memo, are already thinking that that could change their prospects of staying in power. And I think they are nothing but realistic when they say that. And if that should occur to anybody in the administration, that maybe the door could be opened for that some way. As Goering said, I set the Reichstag fire. later. That's possible. And if anybody knows of such plans in the government, then my advice to them would be, don't do what I did. Don't wait till the war has started against Iran and Syria. Don't wait till the bombs are falling. Don't wait till thousands more people have died before you decide to go to the press and to Congress, not just to Congress alone. That was another mistake I made, waiting a year and a half for liberals in Congress to put this stuff out before I went to the press and lit a fire on them. And as I say, by the time I did it, I didn't have documents on a current administration. I'm sorry to say that I believe that with the information in my safe in 1964-65 and the safes of scores of other people, the war, if I'd put that out at the time, there would have been no Vietnam War, period, in 64. Timing matters. Once the bombing had started, once the troops were over, in 1966, it would not have stopped the war. I still wish I'd done it, but it wouldn't have made the difference. I am saying now, I wish Richard Clark had told us in 2001 and 2002 what, to his credit, he did tell us in 2004, but it was late at that point. The war was well on. Mike Scheuer wrote a book, the pseudonym Anonymous, of CIA, who knew what was coming, knew that it was disastrous, and didn't tell us about it till it was well underway and had it cleared. Same as me earlier. I'm saying to these people, do what I wish I had done in 64, 65, and tell us the truth now. There are many Americans who could be doing that right now. It's not too late for Powell to start telling us some of what he needs. It's second best, but not too late for his chief of staff, Wilkerson, to be telling us now that this cabal worked our, manipulated us into war. What he knew, in other words, in 2001 and 2002, would have been good if he'd done it then. But there are further wars ahead, and there's a lot to go. One last thought here. I know I'm supposed to end and give some questions. I look at the paper today, and I see the sort of thing that is causing our popularity to go down. That is, I'm sorry, Bush's popularity to go down in the country. The Saturday Star Ledger headline, Four Soldiers Marine Become the Latest to Lose Lives in Iraq. And the inner headline, similar, in the paper today. Where is it? Well, anyway, that's the point. The latest to lose lives in Iraq. Here it is. Four soldiers, Marine, added to casualties. How many people here see anything wrong with that headline? Anything wrong with the headline? What do you see? And one Marine, it's four soldiers and a Marine, become. U.S. casualties. What it says is the latest to lose lives in Iraq. Were they the latest to lose lives in Iraq? Who, what civilians, we move to the passive tense. What Iraqis lost their lives, let's not say who killed them, and in the action or the circumstances under which these Marines lost their lives. Latest two casualties. What was the headline last time you saw a headline or a story that gave you an estimate of the Iraqis who have lost their lives in this context? Never. Now, that's not just a government handout. That's our press. I'm sorry, there's somebody here from the Star Ledger today. Am I singling out the Star Ledger? Is it different in some other paper? Of course not. Now, the people here are capable of knowing. I remember I once sent Henry Kissinger into a very unwanted, in a public meeting after I copied the Pentagon Papers, but before they'd come out, I had a chance to ask him a question at a public meeting, and the question was, what's your best estimate under your plans of the number of Vietnamese who will die in the next year of our operations? knowing that they had estimates of the number of rubber tires we needed for our planes, the number of gallons of gasoline, and the number of U.S. casualties, threw him into a totally at a loss. He says, "You're trying to accuse us of racism." I said, "No, no, forget the Vietnamese. Just say, how many people will die in the next 12 years? He says, "That is a very cleverly worded question." And I said, and then again, I said, "Well, it's not a simple question. What's your answer?" "What is your alternative?" I said, "You know, Mr. Kissinger, because I'd worked for him on options. I wrote his first paper for the National Security Conference on options in Vietnam. I said, Mr. Kissinger, I know the language of alternatives and options. I'm not asking that. I'm just asking, what is your estimate of the number of people who will die under your policy?" And he, long pause, questioning, went around, paced around, had no answer. And the moderator ended, said, "Well, Dr. Kissinger has had enough questions tonight." And he left, having said earlier in the day, by the way, in that very same talk, somebody had asked him a question about something. He says, you're asking as though we were trying to widen the war. We are not widening the war. I tell you, we are winding down the war, and it will continue to wind down." This was in the spring of 1971. He left that night to go back to Washington and follow the pre-invasion bombing of Laos. The invasion of Laos took place 2 days later, after that talk. I'm saying we're looking right now at a widening of this war to Syria, it appears. It's happening right now. And to Iran. And it's up to us to do something about it. The reason not to do about it, to do anything, was given by U.S. Grant, General of the Union Armies in Civil War and later president, and in his memoirs I came across this passage, his attitude to the Mexican War. "I was bitterly opposed to the measure and to this day regard the war which resulted as one of the most unjust ever waged by a stronger against a weaker nation." This is the Mexican War. "It was an instance of a republic following the bad example of European monarchies in not considering justice in their desire to acquire additional territory." Now, I read this, I studied up on the Mexican War and learned for the first time it was the clearest cut occasion of aggression in our history until this. So this is going on now. He was a second lieutenant, then a first lieutenant in that war from beginning to end. He said later, "I am ashamed that I did not resign my commission. I had not the moral courage to do so." And this was the part I wanted to get to. He said, "The presence of United States troops was not sufficient to provoke hostilities in the disputed territories. We were sent to provoke a fight, but it was essential that Mexico should commence it. It was very doubtful whether Congress would declare war. But if Mexico should attack our troops, the executive could announce, quote, whereas war exists by the acts of," that's exactly what did happen, denounced by very few people in Congress except for Abraham Lincoln, which limited him to 1 2-year term. He was sent back because he denounced it. "Once initiated, there would but few," this is Grant, "there were but few public men who would have the courage to oppose it. Experience proves that the man who obstructs a war in which his nation is engaged, no matter whether right or wrong, occupies no enviable place in life or history. Better for," this is what Grant is saying he should have done, but he didn't. "Better for him individually, quote, to advocate war, pestilence, and famine than to act as obstructionist to a war already begun." And as I say, this stuff is very old. That goes back to, 1845 and so forth. And it's up to us. That's the situation we're in. If you're asking why the Democrats acting like cowards and passive, they don't want to be called names for the reason that Grant gives. They don't want to be called unpatriotic by an administration that uses that very promiscuously, very freely. They don't want to be called traitors, weak on communism, not communism, that was the old one, weak on terrorism, weak on Osama bin Laden, etc. Got to do it. When I was about to go on trial, I'm sorry, I was on trial. I've been on trial for almost 2 years. I was about to go on the stand after 4.5 months of trial. And we'd heard all the other witnesses, but the jury had to hear me, and they had to hear, believe me, rather than RAND officials who had committed perjury about what I had done. I wanted to say openly, frankly, with the facts of what I had done and explain why. They had lied directly about what I had done. The jury had to believe me. So one of my lawyers, Charlie Nesson, said to me just before I went on the stand, "Now, Dan, the main thing for you is to be calm, reasonable, steady, calm. Just remember, it all depends on you." And so that's what I'm telling you. It all depends on you. Thank you.
Daniel Ellsberg, former defense analyst and whistleblower, speaking last week in New Jersey. Though Ellsberg made clear that the confidential Republican memos stopped short of advocating staging another terrorist attack on American soil in order to create a pretext for martial law, it is clear that he is reading between the lines. "And it's up to us," he suggests, and one might ask, "but what can I do?" The first step is to make the commitment that you will not submit. Then spread the word. You can download an MP3 of this program from our website, unwelcomeguests.org, and copy it and give it to others. And you are listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP, Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP, Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. We'll take a break and then come back with Bruce Gagnon.
I heard terrorism makes good television. It's no coincidence, and as a matter of fact, if it weren't guaranteed to be on television, there'd be less reason for a terrorist attack. I heard television loves an enemy. It's no conspiracy, but it's still crass. It's Cheer the Home Team, and it's Exile the Underdog, and it's Feel Fantastic after kicking someone's ass. We saw what happened in September and what happened after that fall. Sick to my spine, I remember, but I lost count watching those towers fall. A march for peace in October, it was 10,000 New Yorkers long. That night we saw Osama over and over, but no mention that New Yorkers know that killing is always wrong. Television ignores terrorism. When was the last time you saw on your screen assassinations and bombings and bulldozers that are just a part of our government's routine? Assassinations and bombings and bulldozers are just a part of the government's routine.